From the studios of NPR West, I'm Tony Cox. Since the 1970s, Truth and Reconciliation Commissions have cropped up around the globe, and they've been held in Peru, Guatemala, El Salvador, and most famously in post-apartheid South Africa. No such commission had ever come to the United States, however, not until this year, when survivors of what some call the Greensboro Massacre set up the Greensboro Truth and Community Reconciliation Commission. It is charged with determining the truth, causes and consequences of the November 3, 1979 killing of five anti-Klan demonstrators. Unlike other commissions, the independent Greensboro body is not officially sanctioned by government. It is also not a legal body, having neither the power to subpoena nor to grant amnesty. Nevertheless, supporters hope it will bring healing to a divided community. From Greensboro, North Carolina, Jordana Gustafson has this report.
The murders happened in broad daylight, just after 11 a.m. on the corner of Carver and Everett Streets, in Greensboro's all-black Morningside housing project. Black, white, and Latino union organizers and demonstrators were gathering for an anti-Klan march. In the footage captured by one of four television crews present, protesters can be seen setting up their PA system in the bed of a pickup truck and taping "Death to the Klan" signs to the backs of vehicles. In one shot, black children in collared khaki shirts and red caps punch an effigy of a Klansman, while adults around them sing pro-communist, anti-Klan, and anti-racism songs. But the march planned for that day never took place. A 9-car caravan of 35 Klansmen and neo-Nazis arrived and slowly rolled past the small crowd.
Death to the Klan! Death to the Klan!
In one cameraman's footage, protesters turn toward the procession and begin to chant.
Death to the Klan! Death to the Klan!
One black man is seen slapping his chest, yelling at the men to get out of their cars.
Death get out! The get out!
A scuffle breaks out, which can be seen briefly in the television footage before the shooting begins. In some of the footage, white men in plain clothes are seen walking about, cocking and aiming long rifles over and around parked cars as cigarettes dangle from their mouths. Within 88 seconds, five leading union organizers lay dead, three of them white, one Latino, and one black. A number of demonstrators return fire, but not a single Klansman or Nazi is killed. As the suspects drive away, demonstrators crawl out from under and behind cars. A few shouts break the silence, and one voice is heard swearing, "Where are the cops?" A woman answers him.
Do you hear me? The cops are hiding because they prepared for this. That's why they're not here. They weren't here to protect us. They hid, man.
While organizers say the violence took them by surprise, a confrontation between the two groups was not entirely unexpected. Some had worried that the unionizing effort within the textile mills would put blacks on equal footing with whites, and in some accounts, members of the Communist Workers' Party had months earlier dared the Klan to come to Greensboro. Suspects in the case were twice acquitted by all-white juries. In the state criminal trial, Klan and Nazi defendants successfully claimed self-defense, and in the federal trial, the defendants were again acquitted. The case was prosecuted under a statute that required proof that racism was the motive for the killings. The defendants convinced the jury that this was not the case. A consistent theme that emerged in the media coverage was that the November 3rd massacre, as it's been called, was an unfortunate incident that occurred between two extreme groups, the United Racist Front, comprised of Nazis and Klansmen, and Communists. Carolyn Allen, Greensboro's mayor from 1993 to 1999 and town resident since 1962, says politics played an important role in the public's perception of the event.
General attitude that unions were wrong and had no place in North Carolina. The other thing that many people have forgotten is how strong the anti-communism thesis was, and how deeply ingrained it had become in all citizens that communism was bad.
In a 1985 civil suit, the city of Greensboro and individual Klan and Nazi members were found liable for one of the five deaths. The city paid $350,000 to the victim's widow. But according to Carolyn Allen, that payout hasn't done much to alleviate the deep distrust of city institutions still found in Greensboro's minority communities.
I recognized that within the African-American community, there were many people whose voice had never been heard that went back to 1979, and that the sense that the police set up that situation and let it happen was very strong, and there was a fair amount of evidence to suggest that it was true. And that set a stage for ongoing distrust.
But what to do about that lingering distrust is what Allen and others hope to address with the Greensboro Truth and Community Reconciliation Commission, a project they believe can bring healing to a community still affected by the events and outcome of November 3rd. The commission, funded by private foundations, begins its work next year. Its board is made up of 7 individuals, including an attorney, an educator, and a former city councilwoman. Ultimately, they will present a report based on court documents, police statements, newspaper articles, and most importantly, testimony from those affected by the killings. Neither Greensboro's city council, the police department, nor the county board of commissioners has officially endorsed the commission. According to former Mayor Allen, support for the project is divided largely along racial lines. City Councilman Robbie Perkins, who is white, says Greensboro cannot afford the negative press that a Truth and Reconciliation Commission brings the town.
Greensboro needs to be perceived as a progressive southern community who wants to be a place where diversity is accepted, where people can get good jobs, we're a university community that we have 25,000-30,000 students that are here, and we want them to stay here. We don't want to be perceived as a southern backwater where people are shooting each other on the streets.
Perkins blames outsiders for the attack and says their views were not shared by the larger Greensboro community. He also questions the impartiality of the commission, which he feels is a one-sided effort orchestrated by survivors who want to rewrite history to their liking. Commissioner Cynthia Brown disagrees. Brown was a student in Greensboro in 1979. Her concern, she says, is for all those involved and affected by November 3rd, and she's committed to documenting the truth in all its complexities.
It has become clearer to me how complex this situation is, because as you think about this issue, there is a labor dimension, there is a dimension that deals with the anti-communist sentiment, not only in Greensboro, but in this nation. There is a dimension that deals with race that is undeniable.
Morningside Homes, where the killings took place, no longer exists. Neither does Carver Street. Today, a tree stands in the corner of a block-sized dirt lot, surrounded by a short red brick wall and a chain-link fence. It marks the spot where marchers gathered 25 years ago. The streets are lined with brand-new, pastel-colored houses, and African-American children on their way home from school cut diagonally through the undeveloped lot and past the tree. According to Councilman Perkins, November 3rd isn't part of most people's memory. He says 70% of Greensboro's residents didn't live in the town 25 years ago. A spokesman for the Greensboro Police, when asked to comment on alleged police complicity in the killings, said he'd have to do some research into the event. He pointed out that most Greensboro police officers today were not even part of the department in 1979. Last month, survivors and supporters finished the march that never began, and at the rally afterwards, friends and family members of the shooting victims introduced themselves to the hundreds gathered there that day. One by one, they stepped up to the microphone. "My name is Caesar," said one young man with blonde hair. Seconds later, a Latino man introduced himself. "My name is Caesar," he said. By the end of the introductions, 3 Sandys and 2 Caesars had introduced themselves, all young 20-somethings named after 2 of the 5 slain activists. They are 5 individuals who can't forget what happened that day 25 years ago. For NPR News, I'm Jordana Gustafson in Greensboro, North Carolina.